This is tape number 9 of Goblinhood Satyricon, copyright 1995 by James Biotti, read by Goblinhood. This tape commences somewhere in the second half of the novel. Basically, it's in the middle of the discussion of the Norse god Loki. Another science fiction writer, Lester Del Rey, wrote a similar novel in 1959 called Day of the Giants, in which Loki was called the evil companion by the other gods, but was portrayed sympathetically and characterized as being friendly to humans. Not unlike Prometheus, except that Prometheus brought fire to humankind, whereas in Del Rey's story, Loki brought nuclear weapons to the gods. It's interesting to note in this context that Collier's Encyclopedia of 1959 vintage suggests in volume 12, page 490, that Loki was originally a, quote, fire demon, unquote. This fragile connection with Prometheus is highly ironic, if not entirely apropos, because following the mistletoe caper, Loki was punished in Promethean fashion. Only instead of being chained to a mountaintop with an eagle chewing at his guts, Loki was consigned to chains or other bondage gear in an underground cavern deep within the bowels of the earth. In fact, according to Collier's Ibid, Loki was actually bound with the bowels of his son, Narfi, bowels which later turned to iron, destined not to break until the twilight of the gods. Suspended above Loki's face was a venomous snake, hard cheese and all for that poor snake being stuck there like that. But so what, eh? Maybe the snake had done something wrong too, but it was just too insignificant to get into the myth. Anyway, the snake dripped venom into Loki's face, causing him to writhe in convulsive agony and to shake the earth, which is supposedly where earthquakes come from. According to one source on Norse mythology, a likely saga. Fortunately for Loki, his wife Sigyn was there to catch the venom in a bowl, but every time she had to empty that bowl, more earthquakes. According to Del Rey, Sigyn was one of the giants and didn't get along all that well with her diminutive hubby. So this venom-catching routine would have been awfully damned nice of her, don't you think? Loki had something else in common with Prometheus, who was a titan rather than a god. According to mythologist and classicist Edith Hamilton, Loki himself was the son of a giant whom Odin, for some inexplicable reason, had sworn brotherhood with. Collier's agrees with this pedigree, citing Loki's father as Farbauti and his mother as Laufey, both giants. Marvel Comics, in its long-running Thor series, always cast Loki as Thor's evil half-brother or something. Most myths have it that Loki was partially or fully responsible for Ragnarok, the twilight of the gods, the final battle of the Asgardians gods against the giants and against monsters like the dog Garm and like Fenris, the gaping wolf. But then after all those earthquakes, what does anyone expect? Robert A. Heinlein associated Loki strongly in the book Job, A Comedy of Justice, with the concept of parallel worlds, alternate universes, and interdimensional travel. For whatever it's worth to anybody, another Norse myth involves the squirrel Ratatoskr, a sort of vest pocket Loki figure, in the topmost branches of Yggdrasil, the great ash tree which encircled the earth, lived an eagle. A serpent lived at Yggdrasil's roots. Ratatoskr traveled back and forth between the two, sowing seeds of dissension. Collier's Encyclopedia, 1959, Volume 8, page 162. In Norway, on the other hand, the squirrel is regarded as a mere postman carrying messages between the different animals who inhabit the forest. Ibid. In the book Man and His Symbols, edited by and with an introduction by Carl G. Jung, Dell Publishing Company, 1964, the Jungian essayist Joseph L. Henderson discusses the myth of the hero in the article Ancient Myths and Modern Man. This essay postulates four stages to a hero in myth, all of which Henderson derives from a 1948 publication by Dr. Paul Radin called Hero Cycles of the Winnebago, an obscure tribe of North American Indians. The earliest and least developed stage of a hero myth is called the trickster, a figure with the mentality of an infant, and one whose physical appetites dominate his behavior. Henderson goes on to describe the trickster in this way, lacking any purpose beyond the gratification of his primary needs. He is cruel, cynical, and unfeeling. Henderson cites the Southern folklore character Br'er Rabbit as a typical trickster. An illustration also cites Charlie Chaplin as a trickster in the film Modern Times. According to the Winnebago, the hero evolves through three later stages, which they call the hare, red horn, and twin cycles. But since the last one culminates in the hero's sacrificial death due to hybris or hubris, it shouldn't surprise anyone that a trickster hero would refuse to grow out of that phase if he or she thought they could get away with it. Anyway, the book's editor also chose to illustrate the trickster aspect with an image of Loki. Goblin Hood himself was a trickster by nature, many of whose tricks were turned in public. But he was also a trickster by lineage. His ancestor, Robin Goodfellow, the Puck of William Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream, was a noted trickster type. The gob was descended from Puck by way of Robin Hood. Actually, Goblinhood was a lot like Shakespeare's fairy monarchs Oberon and Titania combined, squabbling over Maya, perhaps, with a side order of Puck, large fries, and a Coke. The gob also smacked a little bit of Nick Bottom, trying to portray Don Quixote and Sancho Panza at once. But instead of the head of an ass, Goblinhood had the ass of an ass, and a mind like a windmill. He was more fun than having your marrow be full of donkeys. It was some fun, indeed, while the fun lasted. But nothing ever seems to last all night. Meanwhile, like Odysseus, another famous trickster, Goblinhood was also a great voyager and a raider of cities in a harmless sort of way. And like the Greek Odysseus with Circe and the Cyclops, Goblinhood also hung out with witches and was ever on the lookout for someone's eye that he could penetrate with a hot shaft. Someone's brown eye, that is, nyuk, nyuk. And like the bowels of Sidon, opening unto Alexander, Sodom engulfed the gob and elevated him to the highest possible status, though he was but a mere figurehead for the collective dream. And like Alexander before him, Goblinhood was well on his way down the road to debauched ruin and dissipation after only a few golden tarantula binges. Worst of all, perhaps, due to the treasonal content in the potion, G.H. was actually becoming addicted to treasonal aphasia, addicted to forgetting what he was about to say just before he said it, but always being convinced that whatever it had been was world-shakingly important, even if it was just a bunch of dopey nonsense, which it usually was. But that was part of the kick, the conviction that he had world-shaking things to say, if only he could remember them. And the gob often met some pretty weird people to try and remember what to say to while hanging around at the Golden Tarantula, sucking up Golden Tarantulas with a bunch of loyal Golden Tarantulas who were usually sucking up to him. Once, for instance, he met a famous Eastern Bloc science fiction writer, Oleg Penkovsky, who, in some other continuum, had escaped to the West and had actually won a Hugo Award for his novel Twilight of Magog. Now he was here.
"I heard about what happened to St. Cloud," said the ex-Soviet best-selling author. "It seems a great pity."
"Yeah, well, he wasn't the only globally genocidal megalomaniac to ever come down the pike," commented the gob kind of pointedly. He wasn't disguised this time, but was surrounded by a phalanx of crack black widows instead.
"All's well that ends well," responded Penkovsky vapidly, chugging the rest of his golden tarantula and choking down a pickled egg. "But this treasonal drug now," he said around the egg, trying to change the subject. "Do you know where the name came from?"
"From the film Failsafe," explained G.H. "The scene where the Americans try to help the Soviets try to shoot down an American plane. It seemed as if they must have been taking treasonal to be able to do that. Then they apparently overdosed on treasonal and nuked New York to the musical accompaniment of everyone's telephones loudly melting.
Say what? Said Pinkovsky.
What?
Said the gob, who had forgotten what the conversation was about.
Never mind, said the eminent Russian scribe of the science fiction apocalypso genre, who was already well aware of the mnemonic side effects of treasonal, though he kept forgetting them.
Mind what? Asked G.H., now totally confused.
Are you with me on that?
Wondered Pinkovsky vaguely, suddenly suffering from a bad case of conversational drift.
It always seemed as if...
Whatever, countered the gob in a bemused tone, giving up at last.
Yes, that's one way of putting it,
agreed the other barfly, hoping that settled matters and wishing someone truly interesting would show up. Someone like the Shogun Squirrel.
The Shogun Squirrel. Aye, there was a lad.
But the lad found itself, unfortunately, unable to participate in this disoriented episode by virtue of lying comatose at the time in a disreputable gutter with a skin full of rock gut bathtub bliss. And it was indeed to such a pretty pass that matters had come by the time the Black Widow's membership hit the 2001 mark, and things continued to become more and more like that all the time. It was about the only thing that anyone could count on never to change. And things never changed as far as treasonal hangovers were concerned, other than to get progressively worse. And they were nothing compared to the ichor hangovers. Thus the gob awoke late summer afternoon with his head feeling like 100 Shogun squirrels were slapping each other around in there. Above the pounding of his temples, he could hear pigeons farting around just outside his window. The best psionic palace in the realm, and it had pigeons camping under its eaves. The gob took some coffee out into the dusk and sat on his living room balcony, listening to the Cicada chorus sign off, signifying just how late the afternoon really was, while the cricket shift punched in. Chirping fools they were, in his grouchy opinion, chirping loquaciously about nothing whatsoever. The gob read a note which had been left on his pillow from the night before, by the latest of the Black Widows to come along.
Dear G.H., thanks for last night. You're almost as good as the Shogun Squirrel. Ha ha. Love and kisses. Augusta Smoke.
I'm sure, thought the gob sardonically. He knew how much clout the belligerent rodent had lost when it turned out to no longer even be able to make anybody's pants fall down against their will. So blow it out your ass, squirrel, thought G.H. moodily, as his mind began wandering back to an incident of the previous day. While traversing the sidewalk home from the Golden Tarantula, he'd been startled silly when a pigeon had flopped onto the pavement directly in front of him, seemingly from nowhere. Lying on its back, the dying bird had peered at him oddly. It was an odd portent, without a doubt. It reminded him of another odd sidewalk incident
not so long ago, but at night this time, when a bird, perhaps a pigeon, had lunged past within an inch or two of his face, again seemingly from nowhere, but probably from within a nearby small tree. Not very surprisingly, this led to thoughts about the nocturnal goat suckers, the so-called whippoorwills in H.P. Lovecraft's famous story, The Dunwich Horror. In that story, the birds chirped loudly when someone was dying, waiting to catch the dying person's soul. If they caught it, the chirping went on all night. If not, the chirping stopped when the victim had died. Lovecraft had called the birds psychopomps, which meant messengers from the land of death or something. In The Lurker at the Threshold by August Derleth, quote, in collaboration, unquote, with Lovecraft, the same birds chirped as a warning whenever any monsters were around. Lovecraft's other pen pal, Robert E. Howard, whose most famous creation was Conan the Barbarian, had written a story called Pigeons from Hell, which had scared the shit out of the gob's creator as a boy when he'd seen it adapted as a segment of Boris Karloff's TV show Thriller. It involved someone walking down a staircase with a hatchet buried in his head. Or was that story adapted on Alfred Hitchcock Presents? It had been so long ago. Speaking of Hitchcock, though, nobody could make birds seem scarier than the psycho-pompous director of Psycho and the Birds. Idly, Goblin had thought about Lovecraft's other favorite correspondent and fellow writer, Clark Ashton Smith. Had Smith ever written anything about birds? He was probably best known for his long poem, The Hashish Eater, though it was extremely hard to find copies of it. Of the so-called Three Musketeers of Weird Tales magazine, Lovecraft, Howard, and Smith. Smith had been all but forgotten by the world at large. Undeservedly so, in the gob's humble opinion. As it happened, Goblinhood possessed a copy of Smith's poem, bound in gilded leather and encrusted with jewels, like the gem-strewn poetry itself. This had been a gift from a black widow who called herself Poppycock. She was more butch than most of her sisters and had actually magicked herself up a penis to fuck him with as a refreshing change of pace. But she'd given up the experiment when she saw how disturbed it made him. He was a lot like St. Cloud in that regard. Instead, she'd wound up reaming him with the biggest plastic dildo he'd ever endured, much to his masochistic delight, and saved her psionic dick for the other black widows who could appreciate it. Privately, most of the BWs regarded G.H. as the wimpiest asshole they'd ever come across in some ways. But they loved him in spite of this, or hell, who knows, maybe because of it. At least it was nice to know that there was something they could scare him with besides cannibalism, which didn't scare him all that much. In terms of psionic prowess, Goblinhood could probably have taken on everyone in Sodom with one hand tied behind his back, if he hadn't been so harmless. On top of the prevailing gaze. But this was something nobody wanted to test. Nobody wanted to even think about it. Anyway, Goblin Hood went lurping inside to get the poem from his vast and well-stocked library. Soon he was back on the balcony, rereading it with an eye toward bird references. That binding sure was splendid. Poppycock had claimed to have brought the book here from a continuum where Smith was considered the greatest poet of all time. But G.H. suspected that she'd simply magicked this artifact up as well, in order to seduce him. Come to think of it, it was a damned handsome gift, the equivalent of a literary mink coat. Caressing the precious cover, he seriously considered letting her use her magic prick on him anyway, though the thought left him dry-mouthed and queasy with terror. She happened to catch this thought from wherever she was in the palace and genially projected her reply to him. "Never mind, you poor pussy-assed wimp. You'd never go back to women, and my sisters would get jealous as hell. I'll settle for your tongue up my ass next time we're together. And don't worry, I'll leave the salami at home. Kiss, kiss. I'm busy now. See ya. Bye." She'd signed off. Oh well, it remained a possibility. That woman really had cojones. Smith's poem turned out to have the following bird references: eagles with flailing pennons, vulture birds of hell. And, best of all, a legendary rock, described as a monstrous moonquake throbbing bird, whose saber-taloned feet sport Uranian sapphires fast in frozen blood and amethysts from Mars. It also mentioned a cockatrice, a mythical serpent whose glance could kill, said by Webster's Dictionary to be hatched by a reptile from a cock's egg on a dunghill. The poem was full of reptiles, in fact, and what are birds but feathered reptiles? It also contained countless references to winged creatures like vampire bats, wyverns, hippogriffs, and chimeras. Flying was, in truth, a major motif, understandably, since the poem was about hashish visions. Smith supposedly claimed never to have used this stuff. Reading this feast of delirious surrealism, Goblin Hood couldn't begin to guess what Smith might have been on. Abruptly, Goblin Hood forgot why he'd been reading The Hashish Eater. Speaking of hashish, though. Oh yeah, birds. Goblin Hood took one last look at his favorite passage in Smith's gorgeous masterpiece, which wasn't about birds. Instead, it compared something to the dropped lids of women that endure some loin-dissolving rapture. The gob wondered if Poppycock's feminine tumescence could make him feel as if his loins were dissolving. The passage had all the more poignancy because Clark Ashton Smith, unlike his comrades Lovecraft and Howard, was supposed to have been actively interested in women, The other two seemed more celibate than anything else, though Lovecraft had been married to a woman for a short time. Anyway. Goblin had closed the book and dispensed with the psionic flashlight that he'd been reading by. He thought about birds. Three times, birds had mysteriously gotten into his castle and bothered him, and had had to be chased out. This was in spite of the psionic field, which was supposed to keep bothersome elements out. Now they were even bothering him on the street. The entire matter seemed portentous as hell, but he didn't exactly know in what way, nor could he blame his ignorance on drug aphasia, as the five isolated incidents stuck very clearly now in his mind's craw. That was the trouble with short-term memory loss from these drugs. It seemed to operate pretty much at random, and even what he regarded as psychotic occlusion only seemed to mask the most terrible of memories, often behind the flimsiest screen memories imaginable. It all worked out in a way, but it wasn't that easy to forget unpleasant thoughts, such as forebodings of doom, which seemed to increase along with his consumption of golden tarantulas. And he still couldn't get that dying pigeon's red-eyed, head-cocked stare out of his mind. What had it expected from him, anyway? A state funeral? To hell with it. He sipped his coffee and watched the sun finish setting beyond the palace walls. This majestic domicile had been built in an abandoned area right on the border between the women's quarter and the outsiders' quarter, on the principle that most of the tenants were women and that all considered themselves outsiders. The castle, with new wings being added all the time as the household grew, was a product of psionic labor. The results were occasionally surprising. Once, really out there on Bliss, the gob had inadvertently walked through one of the walls. "Buy cheap, get cheap," he'd muttered, making a mental note to firm up the psionic field there, a note which he'd forgotten almost immediately. Consequently, the gob-shaped hole in an out-of-the-way corridor had remained, eventually becoming a species of landmark to an epic binge. For that matter, he reflected disconsolately, even these sunsets often had a kind of half-assed quality, like a low-budget special effect in a movie made for children. But at least the coffee was good. Sitting there, the gob tried to plan out his day, even though night was rapidly falling. In other circumstances, he could have put in a lot of time looming, lurking, and skulking, like he'd always done back home. But that didn't do much good here. It didn't carry much of a kick when he was surrounded by masked weirdos, some of whom, such as certain black widows, were even scarier than he was. There was always, he supposed, the golden tarantula, though he usually preferred to look in there circa the afternoon of the second day or so on Treasonal. But all this doesn't mean that the gob wasn't happy there in Sodom. Most of the time he was happy as a clam, despite his increasingly frequent intimations of apocalypse. He just wasn't much of a morning person. generally speaking. After a while, though, a bunch of black widows came into his private suite of rooms to cheer him up, the quasi-androgynous poppycock among them, and the good times began to roll. Many, many hours later, he wound up, disguised again, sitting around with his old pals Pinkovsky and the Shogun Squirrel, all guzzling golden tarantulas at the Golden Tarantula, all wearing the same golden tarantula masks as all the other golden tarantulas were wearing.
"I'm getting tired of this dump,"
crouched the squirrel, sitting on the bar, surrounded by peanut shells and half-eaten pickled eggs.
"I'm thinking of opening my own place up."
"That's pretty big talk for a squirrel," mumbled the gob absently, thinking fondly of poppycock with the taste of her asshole still on his tongue. The masked, outraged rodent grabbed the gob's wrist and started trying to give it some kind of special jiu-jitsu twist or something, presumably to flip goblinhood through the air. It didn't work. The Shogun squirrel was speechless with fury, but its fluffy tail was spasmodically jerking with indignation. The gob stared curiously at the futile little martial arts demo, wondering just how squiffed the squirrel was, anyhow. Suddenly, Pinkovsky socked G.H. on the jaw, knocking him halfway over the bar.
"What the fuck did you do that for?" sputtered the gob. "Are you dating this little tree rat or what?"
"I did it for your own good," protested the former Soviet. "I got the idea from Dashiell Hammett's first novel, Red Harvest. This woman twists the wrist of a sick man full of laudanum and starts jerking him around the room. So the fat detective hero busts the guy in the jaw to let him save face, sort of man to man, instead of detective to the kind of wimp that even women can push around. And I figured it was even worse with a squirrel." Promptly forgetting that goblinhood had called it a tree rat, the squirrel vindictively kicked Pinkovsky in the nuts, actually quite a feat of acrobatics from its perch there on the debris-strewn bar.
"Fight! Fight!"
yelled various bystanders, probably including a few disguised and inebriated black widows who were supposed to be keeping a surreptitious eye on their head of state. Pinkovsky went down puking. The Shogun squirrel was no judo master, but it could sure thump a testicle with the best of them. "You know, none of this is all that harmless," opined Goblinhood, bleeding from his lip and watching Pinkovsky writhe around in agony on the floor. "That doesn't work so well in here for some reason, particularly just lately," commented the female bartender, who, for all the gob knew, could have been a black widow under her ubiquitous golden tarantula mask. "Even so," she continued, "the Ruski's shot was supposed to have been meant well, and the squirrel was just supposed to be funny, I guess." "So's the idea of relative function, grumbled the bruised head of state. As for the Shogun squirrel, damned if the touchy little runt didn't actually go ahead and make good its promise, or its threat, to try opening up its own place, a two-bit little hard-boiled casino in a really crappy and run-down section of the Outsiders' Quarter, where property values weren't very high to begin with, but soon dropped to an all-time low. It was called the Squirrel Cage, and it provided some minor diversion for a while, but in the end it came to nothing. Apart from the cheesiness of the operation itself, gambling wasn't much fun in a psionic town where nobody used money, except perhaps as an objective standard by which to assess property values and the like. But the squirrel cage was good for a few laughs, watching the squirrel and Pinkovsky, for instance, both in tuxedos and masks, both quivering with psychic effort while facing off over a roulette wheel, trying to make the ball stop advantageously by psionic interference alone, all in the name of worthless bets. Whoever got tired first lost, until the squirrel got tired of the whole thing and went back to wallowing in gutters instead. But at least the furry little cantankerous loudmouth was too busy to hang around at the golden tarantula for a bit, which ushered in a further temporary golden age in the estimations of many. And so the entire quarter threw a Mardi Gras to celebrate, while the squirrel haunted its asinine casino in solitude, acting like a big-time mobster or even a jumped-up hamster with a ponytail, waiting for customers but invariably having to settle for clowns like Oleg and the Gob, who were its only real friends. Yet they were all pretty much a bunch of hoodlums and egregians, if you think about it. Even that eminent science fiction author and celebrated bon vivant, Oleg Pinkovsky, showed a somewhat shadier side while the squirrel was away. He took the Gob to a seamy house of ill repute, or maybe even terminal repute, run by various outsider volunteers for various spicy reasons of their own. And the Gob woke up really out of it from what he'd been smoking with Oleg the night before. Then he noticed the straps. He was secured to a bed in a circular room whose roof was a dome. Through the dome, he could see stars and two moons. "Now I've done it. This time I've really flipped out," gasped the Gob under restraint.
"Well, not exactly," said Pinkovsky's voice from somewhere behind Goblinhood. "In fact, you're only just now starting to get well after a long and disorienting illness."
"What?"
"Let's not go through all that again, G.H.," moaned the Russian, looking a lot older in a white beard and lab coat and smoking a pipe. "I was really hoping that you'd be coming out of it by now."
The Gob saw fit to remain silent at this point, wondering where in hell the Black Widows were when he really needed them.
"Do you even know where you are?"
asked Goblinhood's erstwhile drinking buddy, who had come around from behind the bed to lean over, peering at the Gob, and to blow acrid pipes tobacco fumes into the Gob's face. Coughing, his eyes watering, the Gob looked around as best he could from his supine and restricted position. The circular room was painted white. The dome seemed to be made of plastic or glass, and started about 7 feet up the walls. There were also small portholes here and there. The room had a door, various small tables, cabinets, and shelves seemed to contain or to be covered with various medical-looking apparatuses. Other than that, there were only his restraining bunk and Pinkovsky in front of him, anyway. Cautiously, G.H. shook his head, trying desperately to remember what he and Pinkovsky had been doing the night before, assuming it was morning now, though the stars out there argued that it could only be very early morning at best. Pinkovsky sighed.
Let's take it from the beginning, then. You're on Mars, in an installation near the Cydonian Desert region. You're part of the 1986 multinational colonial and scientific expedition. Your job involves studying and interpreting the ancient Martian ruins and artifacts such as the so-called Martian Sphinx.
How am I doing so far? Cut in the gob sardonically, not believing this crap for an instant, feeling betrayed and unwilling to believe Pinkovsky about anything, though having no valid arguments to make against this version of things since his memory had drawn a total blank. Pinkovsky ignored him.
Your name is Goblinhood, as far as we know, sometimes shortened to G.H. or the Gob, for reasons unknown to the rest of us. You signed on under that name, and your government let you get away with it, again, for reasons nobody else here can imagine. But we connect it to the huge birthmark that makes your face look like a spider painted on a black mask with an odd circular shape on your forehead, with eyes and with a mouth in the spider's body. Some people even think that you came to Mars because of this tragic disfigurement in order to get away from other people on Earth. But you soon discovered how much worse it is here, where things are so cramped. You can't get away from the handful of people on Mars, all of whom, I'm sorry to say, find you horrible to look upon, though we all try to hide the feeling. You, however, apparently haven't been fooled, and since you couldn't escape our company, you retreated inwards instead, getting hooked on a local narcotic called Cannabis Majestica, a semi-toxic substance which you consumed in vast quantities whenever you were alone in your quarters, eating the stuff raw rather than smoking it so the smell wouldn't give you away. The effects of this drug totally addled your mind, destroying your capacity to remember the past accurately, among other things. It also allowed you to imagine yourself living in a baroque and absurd fantasy world of some kind, where you were a person of great importance, surrounded by a retinue of beautiful, though masked, women, apparently a fetish of yours. These women were supposedly your houris, as well as being your bodyguards. But this grotesque delusion doesn't surprise me, since you haven't, to the knowledge of anyone on Mars,
had any sexual contact with anyone since you got here. An unfortunate side effect, I'm sad to say, of looking the way you do and of having, unfortunately, an unpleasant personality to boot. All this, at any rate, is what you've told us under questioning. Tragically for us all, however, after several years of rotting your brain on that stuff, and so indulgently deluding yourself as to your whereabouts and your importance in the general scheme of things, you finally became dangerously psychotic. My job as the colony's top psychologist is to make you well again. Once you get past the unfortunately excruciating withdrawal symptoms attendant upon addiction to Cannabis Majestica. He beamed in a fatherly kind of way. The gob thought it over, trying again to remember what had just been happening or to clearly remember anything at all. He remembered the Black Widows, of course, but if what this bearded Russian asshole said was true, then the gob's memories of the Black Widows, most of his memories, in fact, were just so much drug-induced bullshit. He had to admit that, by any objective standard, the whole business with the Black Widows, never fully explained, had seemed way too good to be true. If only his head would clear. It was obvious, anyway, that he'd been taking some kind of weird drug, and yet, the city of Sodom had seemed so real. What about Sodom? He finally came out with.
Eh? Oh yes, that's where you thought you were last night when you killed that cop.
What?
Roared the gob.
When you were questioned, continued the Russian shrink, you claimed that you'd only killed a squirrel, and that it was all a quite harmless joke or something. But I can assure you, Tovarich, that there are no squirrels on Mars. But, small as the colony is, there are, in fact, cops, security officers, anyway. And be sure that they are not very happy with you at this moment.
T.H. fell silent again. Killed a cop? This put a new and very ugly complexion on things. After a while he said, rather more tentatively than otherwise,
You seem to know your way around here pretty well, Doctor.
Спасибо, comrade. I try, replied the flattered Dr. Oleg. But of course, as I just said, Mars isn't that big, you know. Or at least, the colony isn't.
Can you give me any idea of just how much trouble I'm in here? Demanded Goblin Hood, cutting to the chase.
Plenty, son, believe you me. But I can help you, T.H. That is, if you'll help me.
Pinkovsky sounded suddenly eager.
How do I help you?
Asked the gob, suddenly suspicious.
Following my psychiatric evaluation, your substance abuse withdrawal treatment, and therapy by me designed to make you sane enough to stand trial for your crime, you'll be shipped back to Earth to face murder and other charges in court. Under the laws of your own country. It's done this way with all capital offenses, yammered Pinkovsky. When you get there, I want you to deliver a message to your government.
Why don't you deliver it?
Because for some reason they won't believe me, replied Oleg in an aggrieved voice.
So what's the message? Wondered Goblin Hood aloud, though this was all sounding sort of familiar.
The Soviets are planning a massive nuclear attack on the USA, blurted Pinkovsky triumphantly. They call it Operation Red Harvest, and your government must believe me.
For Christ's sake, Oleg, not that again. Hell, you're the one that's crazy around here.
Goblin Hood was disgusted at the one-track quality of the Russian's mind, even here on Mars. Red Harvest, indeed.
Yes, of course, I'm the crazy one, my boy,
purred Oleg.
I expected you to say that. Surely you know that all madmen say that about their doctors, sooner or later. But if you won't help me save your own country, he growled ominously, perhaps I can persuade you to be a little bit more patriotic and cooperative with some of these bright, shiny, and very painful surgical instruments lying around here.
That'll about do from you, Pinkovsky, said a new voice. One of the Black Widows had just walked through the wall. She left a Black Widow-shaped hole behind her, through which Mars seemed to peer. A dildo-shaped ray gun in her hand was pointed at the kindly-looking, psychopathic old Russian scientist. Another Black Widow, stepped through the wall beside her, leaving a similar hole. She held a steaming cup of coffee in her hand, and she gaily exclaimed,
"Well, here's the scissors at last, and high time to stop."
Everyone stared at her, and she seemed to slowly redden under her mask.
"I was quoting from Kafka," she said, kind of lamely. "From Jackals and Arabs, you know. Anyway, I brought you some coffee, Goblin Hood. I figured you might need it right about now."
That was dead on, anyway. The Black Widows proceeded to unstrap the gob while Pinkovsky stood around looking frustrated. As soon as the women had come in, but after the business about Kafka had been straightened out, he'd taken off his fake beard and stamped on it and thrown his pipe across the room, cursing in Russian.
"How'd you find me here on Mars?" asked the gob, sipping his hot coffee and lighting up a square.
"You're not on Mars, you poor dumb fuck," trumpeted the Shogun squirrel, marching through one of the previously made holes in the wall and wearing a tiny space suit.
Where does it keep coming up with these tiny tuxedos and space suits from? Wondered the gob to himself, kind of irrelevantly.
"That should be obvious,"
replied one of the Black Widows aloud, having read his mind. Her leather jacket bore the name LSD, painted on a lapel.
"It used what little psionic technology it's capable of mastering, being what it considers as appropriately dressed for these corny little escapades, is just about its speed, psionically speaking."
"If you big perverts are talking about me,"
bristled the snarling squirrel, but it had to continue its rant from upside down. The other widow, the literary one, whose lapel labeled her Mescaline, had picked the miniature space hound up by its fluffy little space-suited tail. Fortunately, because of the space suit, damaging little but the squirrel's dignity and its towering ego. Eventually, the story came out. It seemed that Oleg had gotten GH really plastered on some special weed or something, which caused some of the memory problems and also enhanced the gob's credulity toward logical-sounding gibberish. And then, experimenting with psionics, Pinkovsky had constructed what he called a singularity, a small, room-shaped area in which the harmlessness geish was rendered ineffective. "Then he strapped you down and woke you up," continued Ellis, "and you know the rest." "At first we couldn't find you," added Mescaline, "though we knew you were out slumming in a golden tarantula mask. But we couldn't read your mind, apparently because of the singularity field, although we could read both your minds once we got really close to the field itself, only dimly, though. That isn't Mars out there, by the way. It's just an abandoned warehouse in a remote area of Outsiderville. Pinkovsky fixed it so that everything out there would look like Mars from in here, whereas this place is totally invisible from outside that curved wall. Neat trick, huh?"
"So how did you find me?" wondered Goblin Hood bemusedly.
"Well, the others all went looking for you in other places," eagerly explained Mescaline, who was something of a blatherer. "But we got a line on your possible whereabouts from a friend of yours, a source none of the other widows thought could be trusted. In fact, the others thought this source might have been working in complicity with Pinkovsky, 'cause you were all buddies, you know. In fact, some people call you all the Three Musketeers of the Golden Tarantula. Well, anyway, the others are wandering pointlessly around all over Sodom, but we had the smarts and the guts to take a chance on following up this slightly suspicious lead, and we were right, of course, because now the Shogun squirrel tracked you here with its sensitive little nose," interjected the laconic LSD crisply.
"Damn, and I thought we were friends," grumbled Pinkovsky at the squirrel. This betrayal was obviously worse than a mere thumped testicle during a barroom brawl any day.
If Goblin Hood, Pinkovsky, and the Shogun squirrel were somehow supposed to be the Three Musketeers of the Golden Tarantula, despite all their pointless bickering and brawling, let alone the Russians' deranged conniving, then surely Mescaline and LSD were the Mutt and Jeff, or even the Laurel and Hardy of the Black Widows, at least in terms of talkativeness. Goblin Hood had fond memories of the bubbling chatterbox and her strong, silent, moody, businesslike, but otherwise identical sister. The two seemed to complement each other as far as temperament was concerned, and were virtually inseparable, one of many such bonding units among the widow's vast social structure, and actually a fairly common pattern. Some few of the BWs were, like himself, essentially loners by nature. The majority, however, paired off or formed affinity groups of larger size based on various aspects of their personalities. To most people in Sodom, though, even the personalities of the various Black Widows were virtually identical, but not to the gob, who could also tell them apart by taste and smell, though the differences were subtle. To be sure, his helpless love for them was a matter of paradox in its nuances, even to him. He loved them all equally and more or less identically, as discrete elements of one vast entity. And yet he loved each one personally and individually as well, savoring and cherishing the minute differences between them that made each one unique. These two he particularly loved at this moment for helping to haul his ashes out of the fire of Pinkovsky's madness. And of course they were telepathically well aware of his overwhelming gratitude, which was surely the best reward he could have given them for their help. Besides, they'd be lording it over their peers for days to come, since they alone had had the sheer vision to have taken the Shogun Squirrel's ignorant whims and whams seriously, a fact that the garrulous Mescalin would not fail to remind her thousands of sisters of thousands of times in the days to come. As for how to reward the Shogun Squirrel for its important role in these proceedings, that was somewhat of a problem. Only abject submission to its overbearing self-image could please the yapping little troublemaker, and that, in the gob's opinion, would only make the barbarous rodent's profound ego problems worse. It was a problem, he knew, that he'd have to try and find ways to deal with in the aforementioned days to come. For the moment, meanwhile, the Shogun Squirrel had finally promised to behave itself and was now basking in Goblin Hood's heartfelt thanks, preening itself on the foot of the bed, minus its space helmet, smoking a big, fat, stinking cigar, and tapping the ashes on the floor, looking as if it thought of itself as a master detective. "What happens to Pinkovsky now?" asked Goblin Hood. The Russian was brooding, scowling, and muttering, sitting on the floor nearby, but had largely calmed down and had apparently overcome his mania, for the moment at least. "Nothing," replied LSD. "Well, that is, he'll have to be watched. He's obviously nuts." "The big problem is this singularity business. The whole gauge of harmlessness seems to be breaking, or seems to be weakening or breaking down in small ways, as witness this episode. Something's wrong." They all pondered that for a while. "Does that include that prick-shaped gun you're toting?" asked the gob at last. "This?" responded Ellis, starting to remove the foil wrapping. "It's just chocolate." She bit the glands off and offered Goblin Hood some of the shaft.
"There's just one thing I don't get," commented the Shogun Squirrel a little later, its cheeks crammed with chocolate, starting to do a slow burn about being fed, but trying for once to control itself. The rodent was also trying to sound sagacious, as if it mostly knew what it was talking about, and thus trying to be in with the in crowd. But it had obviously been puzzled by this for quite some time, and now it wanted an answer.
"What do you know about this harmlessness scam, anyway?" it asked the gob, puffing on its cigar and coughing.
Goblin Hood was sort of at a loss about what to say, not wanting his small rescuer to feel left out, but not knowing how much the squirrel's small mind could comprehend about such a subject, and not knowing himself, really, just what was going on about that around here. All I can tell you is where the Marson sigil came from, he finally replied, and then he psionically projected a painting called L'Envoi onto the wall as a visual aid for his convoluted explanation to the squirrel, who was unable to read minds, and thus, like Pinkovsky, who was also curiously listening now, had to actually see the image to know what G.H. was talking about, assuming that even that would do any good, weighing the obtuseness of his listeners' minds against the disorganized and fragmented quality of Goblin Hood's confused little lecture. This L'Envoi painting, which was wide and horizontal and which looked strikingly panoramic when projected on the curved wall, was left over from Goblin Hood's 1992 presidential campaign. The original was presumably still mystifying people back on his home planet, and had derived its title from the last chapter in a science fiction novel by Robert A. Heinlein entitled The Number of the Beast. And talk about derivative, even that chocolate ray gun stunt of LSD's had come directly from Heinlein's L'Envoi chapter. The L'Envoi painting was interesting in itself as the embodiment of a message from Goblin Hood's elusive god. Goblin Hood, for all his professed Mayanism and St. Cloudism, actually considered himself a universalist, a faith which he supposedly shared with intelligent life forms from Zeta Reticuli, according to certain ufologists back in his home con. Like the Zeta Reticulans, G.H. worshipped the entire universe, and did so rather more successfully than St. Cloud managed to worship anything. Maya, of course, was part of the vast being that the gob worshipped, and so it was quite fitting that she would come to personify it for him, since she, like most of the universe itself, was cold, inanimate, and invested only with whatever humanoid spirituality the gob could loan her from his own mind. The gob's creator had once codified this belief system in an artist's statement written for a proposed exhibition of spiritual art, to wit, "My work is primarily a manifestation of my spiritual life. In some ways, I regard most art as essentially spiritual in nature. My earlier work was strongly influenced by fundamentalist Christianity because I was brought up as a Southern Baptist. My greatest spiritual void has been from being that to being whatever I am now. I sometimes call what I am now a universalist. To me, the entire universe that we inhabit is a supreme being. I believe that humans are designed to be the sensory organs, mind, heart, soul, and conscience of the universe. We process information for the universe, both awake and while dreaming. The artists among us then refine and disseminate the information to other parts of the universal awareness for further processing. We are the universe thinking about itself. It follows that most of my work is a form of self-portraiture. In a sense, my work is both an expression of reverence for and self-criticism by the universe. I also seek to achieve a more perfect state of communion with the universe. I'm no longer particularly concerned with an afterlife. Getting harmlessly through this life is as much as I can handle. But when I die, I expect my spirit to live on here through my work, because the essence of my spirit is contained within what I have created, a thought dream by and about the universe, frozen, at least for a while, in time and space. Of course, the preceding document, written for mass consumption, left out certain things, such as that the artist regarded the universe, meant to include the entire matrix, as more female than otherwise, and that he was in love with her and spent a lot of his time trying to have sex with her through Maya, and blaming that, of course, on his hapless Frankensteinian creation, goblinhood. Nor did it bother to mention that that sensory organ bit was cribbed from Vonnegut, or rather from Vonnegut's own hapless Frankensteinian creation, the science fiction writer Kilgore Trout. For that matter, the business about the universe thinking about itself was probably cribbed from someone as well, possibly Carl Sagan. What it mostly left out, though, was that the artist, in addition to processing information of a mundane sort, spent most of his time looking for messages from the universe, often in unexpected places, and sometimes finding them. That's where the L'Envoi painting comes in. One day in 1992, Goblinhood, back where he originally came from, was doing volunteer work at an art gallery, helping another gallery worker clear rubbish from the gallery's basement, which was full of this stuff. One such piece of junk was a huge slab of plywood in sort of dilapidated condition, but mostly sound, about 6.5 feet by 4 feet, with a big circle shape cut out of its middle, and a big arrow, also cut out, pointing at the circle. It had obviously been part of an art installation or something long ago. I can't imagine anyone being able to use this for anything, commented the Gob's companion. Goblinhood was about to agree when the subtly Martian flavor of the holes struck him. Suddenly a painting sprang full-blown into his mind, a painting in which the two big holes could illustrate psionic world destruction if handled in the context of another Heinlein novel, Stranger in a Strange Land. According to this interpretation, the holes represented the psionic destruction, aeons past, of the mythical fifth planet from the sun, now the asteroid belt, by the Martians in Heinlein's story. The painting went on to link this novel with Lovecraft's Cthulhu mythos, and thence, through the Nurgle connection, to Goblinhood's own milieu. From that point, the painting had used one of Goblinhood's more megalomaniacal performances, an apocalyptic joyride called Lingerie, to imply the threat of world destruction at the instigation of his own Martians, a threat which Goblinhood eventually canceled at his National Performance Network gig. He'd never really wanted to be president anyway. The message from the universe, by the way, was that Goblinhood should do this painting, whether he wanted to or not, since the universe had gone to the trouble of preparing those holes in the wood and leaving the thing where G.H. would find it, so that he could threaten the world with the destruction which the universe was, after all, planning to perpetrate eventually. And talk about eventually, His first reaction had been to ignore the sudden brainstorm. He and his buddy had left the junk plywood outside the gallery's back door to be eventually trashed. But it rained that night, and GH spent the entire night worrying about what damage the water might do to his plywood, let alone how he might otherwise be punished for disregarding the secret instructions of his god. He went back the next day to store the wood inside while he thought it over. About 2 weeks later, the day after Lingerie premiered at that same gallery, by the way, he carried the lumber home just because he didn't have anything better to do and was hard at work on the painting within the next half hour, muttering things like, "The universe works in mysterious ways, its wonders to perform," and so on. The Lovecraft Heinlein connection can best be explained by referencing an article from The Spider Web, Sodom's leading newspaper, in which Goblin Hood intermittently wrote a popular column called Profiles in Carnage. Cannibalism, from Mayans to Martians, dedicated to Robert A. Heinlein and to Valentine Michael Smith. Cannibalism is, quite rightly, held to be one of the most sacrosanct taboos of modern human society. I say rightly in total agreement with Robert Heinlein, who in his cult classic science fiction novel Stranger in a Strange Land argued that we can't afford to practice cannibalism because we're so uncivilized. That is, that humans in general, as a race of vicious murderers, would be forever bumping off their enemies and other fellow humans with an eye to the price of long pig. Of course, that doesn't count for a culture constrained by harmless magic, so my readers can all relax. This article will attempt to present a broad overview to the cannibalism scene and will focus on the three basic types of cannibalism. These are 1. Tribal / religion / devotional. 2. Survivalist. 3. Psychopathic / sexual. The first variety goes way back and is perhaps best exemplified by some of the stories of mythologist Joseph Campbell. And some of those examples contain a sexual element too, indicating how interconnected these three types of approach can be. A broad example of the religious sort, though, would be the ancient Mayans, who regularly appeased the sun god that they worshipped by offering up ritual sacrifices. Some people believe that ritual cannibalism was also included in this practice on the part of the priesthood. Various primitive tribes are believed to have eaten the brains and particularly the hearts of their enemies fallen in battle to gain the warrior attributes of the deceased. This can be interpreted as a sign of respect. An echo of these religious forms can be found in the Christian ritual of Holy Communion. The second variety of cannibalism is what the entire human race is probably headed for if it doesn't watch out. And please note that survivalist means both plane crash victims in the Andes and anyone lucky enough to survive a full-scale thermonuclear exchange between warring superpowers, for instance. The odd thing here is that so much mass starvation goes on without people resorting to cannibalism, especially since a lot of famine results from overpopulation, a problem which anthropophagy, i.e. cannibalism, could handily solve. Perhaps this gives new meaning to the phrase, there's no accounting for tastes. The third variety is the province of serial killers and subhuman monsters like the egregious Jeffrey Dahmer of fairly recent vintage. Dahmer sexually violated his victims, killed and ate them, later claiming to have done all this because he was, quote, lonely, unquote. Well, it's not a solution that Miss Lonely Hearts would recommend. Going back a bit further, a weird tale concerning the infamous Donner Party sheds some light on the difference between one sort of cannibalism and another. When the doomed pioneers got snowed in, a group set out on a long and convoluted mission to get help. Young Mrs. Donner devotedly stayed behind to care for her ailing husband. A man named Kiesberg also stayed. At one point, he and Mrs. Donner would be the only members of this group left alive at the camp. The advance party, guided by Indians, was starving. One member suggested eating the Indians, but the party's leader refused, exemplifying the etiquette of good cannibalism. They couldn't eat the Indians until the Indians were dead. Eventually, by eating whoever died first, this party reached help and went back for the others. Back at Donner Pass, the rescuers found everyone dead except for Kiesberg. Mrs. Donner's liver and brains were cooking on a stove. The forensic medicine of the time, of course, wasn't equal to the task of figuring out how long she'd been dead and under what circumstances she'd died, and so on. So Kiesberg was free to go on his way. He's said to have opened a steakhouse in California later on, and to have bragged about how yummy she was. The irony here, at least in the version of this story as I remember reading it, is that there turned out to be frozen horse and ox meat lying around there at Kiesberg's camp, but Kiesberg said he was chowing down on Mrs. Donner's flesh because he preferred the taste. He was probably a bad cannibal. I would hate to have to traumatize the tender sensibilities of my readers by discussing the single most socially taboo aspect of cannibalism that exists, which is the loathsome idea of human flesh being turned into human excrement. One can tell just how taboo this is by the infrequency with which it's mentioned, even when the subject of cannibalism comes up. However, it could be speculated that this attitude of revulsion is centered around early toilet training, in which humans are taught to abhor the byproducts of their own bodies above all else. Given that, it's perhaps easy to see why most people would rather wind up as worm shit. This unpleasant issue is, in any case, deftly skirted by my main case in point here, a modern example of cannibalistic literature that would seem to encompass all three types of cannibalism. Stranger in a Strange Land, by Robert A. Heinlein, published in 1961, in my world anyway, concerns the adventures of one Valentine Michael Smith, a human born and abandoned on Mars and raised there by the Martian Old Ones, who are never fully described by the author, but who practice a
voluntary form of cannibalism which involves what they call discorporation and grokking, and is held to be a great honor for the victim. Food is very hard to come by on Mars. Actually, the adult Martians are the ones who practice cannibalism. The old ones are supposed to be discorporated Martians or spirits. Nevertheless, they run the planet. Interestingly, the Martians don't eat anyone whom they don't like. Instead, they will that being to disappear through some form of psionic technology. They call this wasting food. At one point in their history, the Martians wasted a whole planet full of food. Anyway, Smith learns how to do all this and more. Then he comes to Earth and sets up a religion based on group sex, a weird water sharing ritual, and voluntary cannibalism among friends. In the end,